From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Big changes are coming for young farmers. Some good, some not so much. This week on Farm and Country, we're taking a deep dive into the policies that shape the future of farming in the region. We sat down with Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel from Finca Seremos Farm in Calcun Center, talking sewage sludge, school contracts, and SNAP, real-life policy issues with real-life impacts. Plus, Radio Catskill's Julia Kim makes her Farming Country debut. She explores food justice with Tiana Kennedy and Francis Yu from the Catskills Agrarian Alliance about their mission to build food sovereignty across New York State. All of that in Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report. But first, news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Search and rescue operations continue along the flood-ravaged Guadalupe River in the Texas Hill Country, where at least two dozen people have died and more than 20 people are still missing, many of them young children. Meanwhile, more rain is forecast today. Texas Public Radio's Jerry Clayton has more.
Most of the reported missing are girls at Camp Mystic on the Guadalupe River. Camp Mystic holds as many as 750 campers during the summer. Governor Greg Abbott says the state is working to provide all the assistance it can to help first responders.
I have assured all of the local officials here that whatever they need, whether it be personnel, whether it be equipment, whether it be search and rescue operations, whether it be supporting them in their endeavors, whatever these communities need, the state of Texas is going to step up and provide it.
Officials say more than 240 people have been rescued so far since the flooding began on Friday morning. I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
Along the Carolina coast, heavy rain is forecast for the next couple of days as Tropical Storm Chantal continues its path. President Trump is spending the weekend at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, but before leaving town at a White House 4th of July picnic, he signed a hard-fought bill moving his sweeping domestic agenda forward. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has details.
I was there. It was in Des Moines, and it was meant to be a celebration for America, but really, it looked like any Trump campaign rally, which is to say it was deeply partisan. And there, too, he said he had a couple of weeks of winning that have just passed. After all, Congress passed that new major domestic policy agenda, albeit narrowly. And he had that major strike on Iran and then a ceasefire that is holding at the moment. And then there are also numbers showing that border crossings are way down. And he celebrated that on his trip to Florida this week to a new migrant detainment camp, which the administration is calling Alligator Alcatraz.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reporting. Congress is considering multiple bills that would reform the Federal Emergency Management Agency. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports the president has said that FEMA as it exists now should be eliminated.
FEMA is responsible for responding to major disasters such as hurricanes, earthquakes, and wildfires. The agency has struggled for decades to adequately help survivors of disasters. A new bill introduced by Vermont Senator Peter Welch would make it easier for rural towns to get FEMA assistance and to access federal money to help prevent damage from extreme weather. A separate bill pending in Congress proposes even more drastic changes, including making FEMA a cabinet-level agency that reports directly to the president. Meanwhile, the president has created a FEMA Reform Council that's supposed to make recommendations later this year. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
This is NPR.
Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, letting you know that we here at Radio Catskill are facing an uncertain future. You may have heard about the threats to our federal funding, that we may lose funds that were already approved. And it's true. Because of actions in Washington, D.C., we may lose a quarter of our annual budget. Polls show that Americans oppose these cuts by 2-1, but these lawmakers think they know better than local folks like you. They know better than you what you should hear, what you shouldn't, and what constitutes quality news and information. Congressmen, senators, sitting in D.C., making that call for you. And just for the sake of politics, they're messing with a cherished public resource and pushing stations like ours to the point of crisis. Of course, this isn't just a crisis for us, it's a crisis for the whole community. Radio Catskill's a trusted source of emergency alerts, local news, and cultural programming, and that's why it's more important than ever for you to support this station now at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. If we have to make painful cuts, it will have a negative impact on our whole region. It'll affect the many local events, businesses, nonprofit organizations that we support on air. It'll affect our ability to bring local voices on air to voice local concerns. So please, do what you can. Help us out during our summer fund drive. Go to WJFFradio.org, make a donation, and if you can, spread the word. Share the link. Tell your friends and family we need their help too. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. Again, that's WJFFradio.org. Thank you so much. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, it's 4th of July weekend, so I hope everyone is staying safe and cool and healthy this summer with their loved ones. And the summertime here at Radio Catskill, it actually also means that we have some great summer interns that joined us this past month. A few weeks ago, you may have remembered that I said we'd be adding a few new voices here on Farm and Country. And this summer, I am so excited to share that we have a really incredible cohort of talented summer interns, including Julia Kim. Julia joined the Radio Catskill team earlier this summer as one of our reporting interns and has done some just excellent work on a number of issues, including transgender health and immigration policy. Today, though, she makes her Farm and Country debut. According to the USDA's latest census of agriculture, about 96% of farms in the U.S. are owned by white producers. But in New York State, the percentage is even higher, with about 99% of farms being owned by white people. Radio Catskill's Julia Kim spoke to Tiana Kennedy and Francis Yu, co-executive directors from the Catskills Agrarian Alliance, on how they're working to change that through their mission of food sovereignty. Here is some of that conversation.
In addition to mutual aid, which you guys mention as a huge kind of underpinning of the work you guys do, food sovereignty is a concept that you often use to describe the work that you do. And so my questions with that is, first, what does food sovereignty mean to you guys? And two, how has the current agricultural system in this country failed in terms of fostering food sovereignty?
The idea that we hold is that everybody that eats and everybody that grows and everybody that partakes in the food system should have agency and a collective voice in how food is grown and transported and received, and have decision-making abilities about what sorts of food that they are going to be growing and receiving and eating and enjoying. So the way in which we're hoping to construct our organization and how we're hoping to work with other groups in our region is to create sort of mesh network, a very resilient and two-way communication or multiple communication point food system where all the stakeholders have agency in the process. So it started as just us being a little farm trying to survive, and none of us can survive on our own. I think farming is in the small scale is inherently collaborative. And so it became a collaborative project. And then the more that we work together, the more that we're trying to make it an intentionally collaborative project with a lot of feedback loop. The difference is it's not extractive. Nobody's making money. Nobody's exploiting that we're doing is self-exploiting. But there's not like a big fat cat boss that's like taking profits off of their laborers' backs. the way that the food system has failed is that as monopolies have, you know, increasingly taken over the food system since World War II, efficiency has replaced the idea of resiliency or collaboration or local economies. And that has gutted rural America. It's created a lot of the political problems that we're now dealing with. It's been disastrous environmentally. It's not resilient. You know, it's very fragile. When things happen to these systems, they break and people don't get food.
For all the reasons that Tiana said that kind of give a little bit of the background of our current food landscape, it's like, you know, nearly impossible to have a food sovereign system under kind of like a capitalist, industrialized, globalized food system. I think there are really, really big challenges. I do think that like where mutual aid ties into that is like, for me, mutual aid is also about like, how can we go up with the resources that we have? And then also, I think importantly, like, how do we also raise a critical eye to the systems that have, like, made the conditions what they are?
A central part of your mission is centering, you know, queer BIPOC communities who have historically faced systemic racism in terms of not only like food production, but also food distribution in terms of who has access to food. So I was wondering if you guys could kind of go into and explain this history of the USDA's discriminatory practices and how it has impacted BIPOC farmers, I mean nationwide, but if you could speak specifically to the upstate New York region that you guys farm in.
Even in the New Deal, a lot of the subsidies and the programs that were rolled out were only for white farmers. So like this has been going since, you know, Jim Crow era, to, you know, all the way through the 60s. It was finally kind of brought up during the civil rights movement in the 60s, but nobody won a court case until the 80s, and then it's only now barely begun to be addressed, and then now it's being dismantled.
There has been a really big loss in terms of the number of Black farmers, of Asian farmers, space, and who like also have like the support and access to resources or community to kind of like enter farming as like a real livelihood.
There's also been a lot of intentional discrimination around access to capital and access to land for Black and brown communities in upstate New York. So another thing that we do is try to create those spaces to kind of reestablish a status quo that is more equitable. And also we're working with groups that are already in existence, trying to support their work through logistics and trying to find markets for the food. Because it's one thing to do land access. It's one thing to promote farming, but it's another thing to like make sure that there's a market for that food so that to create the farm viability for people.
You offer a sliding scale for your veggie produce and then a limited number of cost-adjusted shares for people who want to participate in that. And so kind of entering this conversation of food insecurity, I was wondering if you could go into the issue of food insecurity specifically within the Catskills, Hudson Valley, and New York City regions.
Let's start at the systems level. You know, in New York City and what we see across urban spaces, we really kind of see the legacies and the history of redlining and how through kind of like that spatial discrimination, segments of our communities, namely Black and brown communities, don't have access to certain kinds of resources and amenities. And, you know, that creates these units we often refer to as food deserts, or I think more accurately and more recently kind of like food apartheid, because they have been very intentional decisions and policies that have created like, you know, this particular lack.
Thanks so much to Julia for that report. You can hear Julia's full interview with Tiana and Francis from the Catskills Agrarian Alliance on our website. That's wjffradio.org. And of course, you can learn more about the Catskills Agrarian Alliance's work on their website at catskillsagrarianalliance.org. Up next, this week's Star Talk report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. There are a few things that are as consistent as the speed of Earth's rotation. Earth completes one full rotation on its axis in 24 hours, or 86,400 seconds. The time it takes Earth to rotate once on its axis is not exact. It varies by about 1 millisecond. This is much faster than the blink of an eye, which is around 100 milliseconds. It wasn't until the 1950s that these tiny variations in the speed of Earth's spin were able to be measured. The clocks used in determining the length of day are extremely accurate.
To give a sense of just how accurate the clocks are, 1 millisecond over the length of one day is the same as measuring the height of Mount Everest to the width of a human hair. Until 2020, the shortest length of day recorded was slightly more than 1 millisecond. This means that Earth completed one rotation about 1 millisecond less than 86,400 seconds. Every year since, Earth has sped up between the end of June and the middle of July. During this time, Earth has rotated around 0.5 millisecond faster. This year, Earth is predicted to spin about that fast again on July 9th, July 22nd, or August 5th. There are three possible dates because there are short-term variations in the length of day that are affected by the moon's orbit. Earth is predicted to spin at its fastest rate for the year on one of three possible dates in the next month. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future StarTalk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and StarTalk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks to Keith for this week's report. Up next, we're talking about some big farm issues in the region, like sewage sludge, school contracts, and SNAP benefits. I know it sounds wonky, but trust me, it all matters big time to young farmers. We've covered the legislative session in a number of ways here at Radio Catskill. And so some of y'all might know that the state legislative session wrapped up this past June. Some environmental bills are on their way to Governor Kathy Hochul's desk to sign, but some got stuck in limbo in the assembly. Here to share more about the impact the state legislative session could have on New York's young farmers are Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel. They're the co-owners of Finca Seremos Farm in Calcun Center. Nickel and Gonzalez are also both members of the Hudson Valley and Catskills Young Farmers Coalition chapters. Brenda and Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good thing. Happy
thanks,
to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Of course. So let's start with the bills that did pass and the bills that did not pass that the local young farmers chapters were monitoring this session.
Yeah, sure. I can start with a bill that definitely had some discussion among the young farmers that we're in community with. And it's actually a bill that arose from some discussions that I was able to take part in with the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. Some listeners may know Wes Gillingham of Wild Roots Farm and is on the Soil Health Subcommittee with me. And we have these conversations about the spreading of biosolids or sludge on fields. But one of the big risks that this practice involves is the introduction of PFAS or forever chemicals. And they can come into this biosludge from a few different ways, from human waste streams that are mixed into these biosludge applications, and from industrial uses, byproducts like pulp from paper mills, for instance, and chemicals that come out of that can be mixed into these sludge applications and have a high level of these PFAS chemicals. And to give you a sense of the scale, we don't have a clear sense of how widespread the practice of spreading this sludge directly on fields is in New York State. We know it happens in certain municipalities more than others, but we do know that major fertilizer and agribusiness companies are using these biosolids in the preparation of things as common as potting soil. If you get your Scott's mix at the Agway or Miracle-Gro, more and more likely it is these days that contains these biosolids. And so the bill that passed in the Senate but has yet to pass in the Assembly in New York State is a moratorium on this practice.
What about other bills that may have been on your radar?
So the Good Food Purchasing Bill was definitely on our radar. I have a background in education. I spent 15 years in schools. And something that we really hope to do as a business in the future is get our food into schools. The Good Food New York Bill was something that we were excited about because it really incentivizes public institutions to be able to spend more money on diverse farms who can provide the kinds of food that we're growing to the kinds of communities we want to serve. We grow a lot of culturally responsive produce and vegetables and herbs, and we want to make sure that the communities that really love those foods are getting those foods in as many places as possible, including in school settings. But right now, public institutions in the state are required to use a bidding process to procure food, and they have to go with the lowest bidder. And that creates a lot of incentive to reduce the price as much as possible, cut corners on labor, cut corners on safety, cut corners on environmental protections, so that you can get your bid in. So right now, for a farm like us, we're a second-year farm. We're really passionate about the community work that we're doing. We really believe in making sure that our labor practices are really solid and that they're sustainable and that our employees are able to do this work for as long as they want to. All of those considerations make it much more challenging for us to participate in any kind of bid process. We are essentially priced out if we want to have the kind of work environment and the kind of pay that makes our work sustainable.
Yeah. What I thought was what was interesting about the Good Food Bill this session was that I believe that it was actually passed through the legislature last year. It headed to Governor Hochul's desk in hopes of being signed, but then the governor actually vetoed it last December. Hochul said that one of the reasons why she decided not to sign it is she said that the way that the bill is written, it would lead to different standards across different jurisdictions, which she alleges would actually make it harder for local growers to secure contracts. I'm curious, like, what you have to say to those concerns. Is that necessarily true?
So I think our understanding of the veto is that it was pretty political. Generally, if the governor is going to veto a bill for principal reasons, she's probably going to do it a little earlier than the very end of December, which is the last moment for her to exercise that veto right. And I think you can look to the Farm Bureau's opposition to this bill to help explain Governor Hochul's veto. Mm. I think that is a Farm Bureau talking point. And frankly, I don't think it really holds water. And this year, I think we're very pleased to see that Senator Hinchey's bill passed with a veto-proof majority in the Senate. So 42 of the senators voted yes when it passed at the end of this session. And so if the Assembly comes back, say, in the fall, they'll have another opportunity to pass this. And if they get a supermajority as well, then it can't be vetoed. And that would be really exciting.
Let's talk some bit about funding. President Trump's quote-unquote big, beautiful bill, it passed through the House of Representatives. It's now with the Senate, and it had, you know, initially included an estimated $230 billion in SNAP cuts over 10 years and would pass a significant amount of those SNAP cuts onto states specifically. I'm curious what some of these cuts that are being considered in the bill, what would that mean actually for the communities that you serve?
Yeah, that's a hard one. When we sat down to prepare for the end of our season last year after the elections, we anticipated this coming. And it was really concerning for us because 30% of our members last year were using SNAP benefits to buy their CSA share. Our goal this year was to have 40%. And our ultimate five-year plan goal is to have 50% of our members using SNAP benefits because everybody should be able to get quality, culturally responsive food, regardless of what their income is. So we knew right away that we needed to start making moves, and we leveraged our community and our sliding scale to try to mitigate the cuts we were anticipating seeing. But it literally takes foods out of people's mouths. We have members who were SNAP members who we haven't heard from at all this season, and we suspect that it's because they don't think that they can afford to pay for a share this year. And that's hard. They were people we were seeing every single week, who we have relationships with, who we now don't have that connection point with anymore. I mean, food is medicine. We're talking about not just taking food out of people's mouths. We're talking about really impacting people's health.
Well, oh my goodness. So you're already seeing people who receive SNAP benefits or that you've been in community with already kind of pull back from the way they interact with you.
Yeah. I mean, they were not receiving enough by any means already when they were receiving their benefits. And I think everyone has been sort of wary that this was a possibility. And so, you know, a CSA is a commitment. It's a commitment for the season. And then I think there are people who don't want to make a commitment that they don't feel like they can fulfill at the start of the season if there's a chance that they're going to lose their benefits midway through.
You know, we talked about how this would impact the communities you serve. What about farmers themselves? How would these proposed cuts specifically impact young farmers and farm owners?
I think what we're seeing among the farming community, especially with young farmers, there are a lot of us who do this kind of more mission-aligned food access work. And a lot of us have been hit really hard by, even before the SNAP cuts that are looming large right now, cuts to food access programs like the Local Food Purchasing Assistance Program, LFPA, that the USDA was supposed to administer in a second tranche this summer, that is better known in New York as the New York Food for New York Families program. It gets passed through the state and administered as under that name. And it allows food banks and food pantries to purchase our food directly using these funds and get it to their clients. And it's some of the best food that they ever get access to. We hear that time and time again. And, you know, as Brenda said, it's a right to have access to this kind of nutrient-dense, preferably organically grown produce. And so these cuts are really impacting the way that we do business. We are trying to work with our local food pantry and food relief partners to help them find additional funding. I mean, philanthropy is really stretched tight right now. The Local Food for Schools program is another federal program that has been cut that a lot of farms were relying on to get food into schools. You know, you had food procurement managers in schools really grooving on getting access to our produce and getting it on the plate for kids of all ages. And to have that momentum sort of cut out from under us is a real shock, and it's a real blow. And I think as young farmers, we're trying to figure out what the strategy is in terms of advocating for the return of this funding and hopefully its increase, and figuring out where other sources of funding can be identified.
There's a lot that is up in the air right now, and I'm curious, what are you keeping an eye out for these next few months?
We're in a very tricky position. I think Brenda described it accurately in a conversation we had a little while ago as between a rock and a hard place. The feds are making good on these threats to massively cut funding, not just SNAP, but also Medicaid, which, you know, Brenda and I both rely on for our healthcare as young farmers. And the state has to figure out how to respond. I think one of the reasons that this legislative session felt so unfinished is because I think most legislators understand it to be so unfinished. You know, I worked in a state legislator's office for about 4 years myself, and I had never seen a session look quite like this one. And the time that I was working in government was during COVID. So that tells you something about the level of uncertainty that I think state lawmakers are facing down right now. And in conversations that we've had with state lawmakers, that we as advocates have had, that's become clear. They fully anticipate coming back to session in the fall once the dust has settled on the federal legislation and the impact of the cuts that we saw the administration make in the first 100 days. And they're going to have some tough questions. How hard can they push their federal colleagues to make good on the funding that was guaranteed and has been cut out from under them versus how much do they then need to dip into the New York Rainy Day Fund, which is about $33 billion. It's not chump change. And I think the calculus for legislators is how much suffering can the people of New York endure before New York just coughs up the money for New Yorkers?
Yeah, we're also really hopeful that they will, as they sort of grapple with this rock and a hard place that they're in, I hope that they will continue to talk to the community that they serve and really stay in touch with their partners in those communities to understand exactly sort of where the breaking points are for people. Because it's one thing to know the technical impact when you're up in Albany and you're on the floor arguing, but it's another thing to deal with the day-to-day reality. And so making sure that they're staying in touch with their communities, making sure that they're staying in touch with local advocates, making sure that they're really aware of the impact that these cuts are having as they sort of negotiate with the feds is going to be really important.
I've been chatting with Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel from Finca Seremos Farm. Brenda and Chris, thank you so much for chatting today.
Thank you, Kim.
Thanks so much to Chris Nickel and Brenda Gonzalez at Finca Seremos Farm in Calcun Center. You can actually find them on Fridays from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Liberty Farmers Market on Main Street. They also have a number of community work days throughout the summer that you can get involved with. You can find all those dates and details on their website at fincaseremos.com. And that is our show for this week. I'm Kimberly Izar. Thank you to all of our guests from the Catskills Agrarian Alliance and at Finca Sinamos Farm for their wisdom and for their reflections. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team, post-production by Ronald Kelson, and contributed reporting by Julia Kim. Up next, it's Catskill Character on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Morgan Outdoors. Celebrating 20 years as a local source for hiking, snowshoeing, and discovering the great outdoors. On Main Street in Hurleyville, near the rail trail. Morgan-Outdoors.com.
It's Radio Catskill's Summer Fun Drive. Because the community supports Radio Catskill, we can bring the community local news, emergency